Campus FM presents a talk organized by Palazzo Falson entitled Blades of Light. The talk is delivered by Joanne Spiteri-Staines.
Good evening. Thank you for showing up on quite a warm evening. Finally, the warm weather has come. This evening's lecture has been organized by Palazzo Falson Historic House Museum. Many of you know the museum. It's just up the road, a medieval building, an important historical and architectural monument in its own right. And this evening we'll be hearing more about architecture, so it links up very nicely to our museum and what we're about. We must pass on now to introduce Joanna Spiteri-Staines, our lecturer for this evening. Thank you, Joanna, for having agreed to give this lecture, which we discussed it over coffee, I don't know, was it about 4 months ago? And I was really excited at the theme she proposed, so, and I've already had a little glimpse of the PowerPoint projection that she, the PowerPoint presentation that she's prepared, and it looks great. But by way of formal introduction, I'm just going to run you through her bio. Joanna Spiteri-Staines is an architect specializing in the restoration and conservation of historic buildings and sites. She's an associate partner at Architecture Project, having joined the firm in 1993, shortly after its inception. Joanna obtained an architecture and civil engineering degree from the University of Malta, together with a master's in Restauro dei Monumenti from La Sapienza in Rome. Her research involved historical analysis and rehabilitation strategies for the Valletta and Floriana historic stores and shoreline. These studies form the basis for the conservation and regeneration currently known as the Valletta waterfront. Subsequent research at the Bartlett University College London included regeneration techniques, heritage tourism, and funding structures for regeneration of historic cities. Joanna has lectured at the University of Malta and also at the Development Planning Unit at the Bartlett, London. In 2009, she was awarded a prize from Dinard Helwa for the conservation and rehabilitation of a 17th century rural palazzo. That was the abode of Bishop Baldassare Cagliares. From 2005 to 2007, Joanna was a board member of the DCC board at MEPA. She's currently a council member of the NGO, Dinard Helwa, and has also worked as an advisor to the Malta Tourism Authority on heritage-related issues and policy making. Joanna has delivered numerous lectures on the topics of rehabilitation of the heritage and good restoration practice. Over to you, Joanna.
Good evening, everybody. The lecture is going to be about the modulation of light through screens, but in particular Islamic screens. 75%, I would say, of the lecture is going to look at the way Islamic architecture utilized the light in a decorative way, and it's going to focus on countries where there is intense heat and intense sunlight, which would mean that one feels that one needs to escape from this intense heat outside to a cool interior where light is modulated in a very particular way, which was used as an architectural effect. The last bit of my lecture will look at how today's technology allows us to work with screens again. And we're going to have a quick look at some work, in some international work, and what a few jobs, a few projects in Malta. We're going to kick off with something a little bit fun. You probably may remember that. It's 1977, The Spy Who Loved Me. And that is Roger Moore, but we're not talking about Roger Moore. We are talking about the Mosque of Ibn Tulun, which is 9th century. And I'm kicking off with some architectural examples in Cairo. I don't know how many of you in the audience are familiar with Cairo, but it's one of those cities which takes you completely by surprise when you actually get there and you start discovering these ancient monuments. Ibn Tulun is one of the oldest surviving mosques in Cairo. It's 9th century, and Ibn Tulun was one of the first people to build something of a certain size and grandeur. When Cairo was attacked by the Abbasids, the mosque was the only surviving building left. This is the courtyard. We're seeing a portico, which is where the corridors beyond the portico start to create a shading effect on the building beyond. Corridors are called ziyadas in Islamic architecture, and the minaret itself is a larger structure. At this point in time, we're talking about architecture still trying to create large buildings and large spans and tall buildings. And it is a copy with its curved helical staircase of the minaret in Iraq, in Samarra. This is an interior view, and if you look at the shape of the arch, you can start to see that it is one of the... It starts to kick in at the springing of the arch. So we're looking at the beginning of the caliphal arch, which is horseshoe-shaped. And this is where we first start to see it. The minaret is built in stone, whereas the brick is the old Roman technique. The dome is the old Roman technique of building in brick. These are the corridors where the light comes through, the sunlight comes through. The decoration, you start to see a little bit of decorative effects on the interior of the arch. The external wall of the mosque, which allowed it to be fortified and defended when it was attacked. And the crenellations, the Merlin crenellations, would have been where people would have protected the mosque from. And this is the Abbasid Caliphate at its greatest extent in 850 AD. Now, I'm going to give you little interjections of history here, because we're talking about 200 years after the death of the Prophet, and the spread of Islam was quite extensive within the first 50 to 100 years. Again, at Ibn Tulun, we'll see this banding between two different colors of stones. It's an Abbasid type of architecture which was used in the Middle East. And this is a quote from an early 19th century writer saying, "In the early morning, the sun shines through the grills into the Ibla Riwak," that being the portico. "As the sun moves, it shines onto the piers of the arches and the floor of the Riwak, revealing the outlines of the windows and the different geometric designs, giving a remarkable effect. Later, the sun shines on the piers and the floor between the piers alternately, and the entire floor is decorated visually along the whole Riwak, creating a magnificent carpet of light. It is at that time one can read the inscription, as the sun is reflected upwards onto the ceiling and illuminates this area." This quote is exactly what the architects were trying to achieve with the architecture and the geometric design and the calligraphy. This is the corridor. This is what he means by the light coming in and illuminating the corridor. And this is another shot. This is Cairo from a distance. It's a very another mosque in the distance. It's a chaotic city. It's great fun. I urge you to go and discover all these wonderful gems. We'll see more of it. But let's do a little bit more about the Umayyads. Now, the Umayyads had extended their empire all the way to Spain, to the Iberian Peninsula, displacing the Christians there. And they remained in Spain. So we're going to be seeing what happened in Cordoba, Granada, and Seville. And this is 750 AD, with Muhammad having died in 632. So we're talking about a very short span of time for an entire empire. The Umayyads had their center in Damascus. And this is the Great Mosque of Damascus. It was constructed in 706 AD. It's nearly Roman in its typology. It's still used, and the materials look very shiny and new because it's constantly refurbished. And the social ambiance is not one of restoring and keeping things looking old. It's of, you know, the paving needs to be redone, you redo the paving. And one of the first mosques which was built was the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, and possibly friends of Palazzo Fozzon could organize a Jerusalem trip. The Dome of the Rock is a very famous mosque. It was, as you know, the center of many battles. The shape was utilized by the Umayyads and Christians as a plan for different varying mosques and churches. The dome is built out of wood, but the sides are all stone, and as you can see, highly decorative. On the inside is an archway with all the banding, similar to what we saw earlier. And these are the Aghlabids. Now, the Aghlabids ruled as early as 800 to 900 AD, and they are Berbers from Algeria in origin, and they're important to us because they conquered Malta, they conquered Sicily, they established Kairouan, which was their first capital, and we probably have quite a few buildings or remnants of buildings which are Aghlabid, and probably urban cores which are Aghlabid in Malta itself. And in Kairouan, they built the Mosque of Uqba. And the Mosque of Uqba was... Kairouan was nothing. It was just desert. And the Aghlabids built Kairouan in 650 AD. That is, you know, close to 20 years after the death of Muhammad. And it's a fabulous mosque. This is an absolutely amazing mosque built in stone and brick. These are the ziyadas, the corridors. It is a precursor of what we're going to see in Cordoba, with this incredible, rich effect of corridors and slide decoration. And this is the brick minaret. And this takes us to Cordoba. Cordoba is a little bit later. It's 784 AD. This is one of the exterior doors. It's an entire quarter. It's the Mesquita de Cordoba, built on the site of a Roman temple to Janus. It was subsequently a Christian church. It's this incredible amount of, I think I wrote down somewhere how many columns there are. Close to 900 columns, taken from, some of them were stolen from Roman temples, some of them were carved out of all the wonderful marbles that one finds in Spain. And it's a forest of columns, as Iqbal says, countless pillars like rows of palm trees in the oasis of Syria. It's the prince Abd al-Rahman, having conquered Cordoba, bought this land. He went through a deal with the Christians, and they were very tolerant. The rulers here were extremely tolerant of all the Christians and Jews, which would explain why Spain and the Islamic conquest of the south of Spain lasted so long. When there was a Reconquista in the 15th century, part of the mosque was turned into a church. So you walk through this amazing mosque full of these wonderful columns, and suddenly you come across the church of Our Lady of the Assumption with this Baroque interior. So it takes you completely by surprise. This is one of the domes with this beautiful decorative effect. And this is again one of the walls. I believe this is the one which faces Mecca, and in this case it faces south as opposed to east, and nobody's really sure why. Now, we're going to go back to Cairo, and I'm going to explain a little bit about the Fatimids. The Fatimids are probably the most important people for the beginning of Cairo. They started the center in Cairo called Al-Kahir, which is then known, commonly known as Cairo. And they are, they're interesting as a people and as caliphs because they wanted to excel in their architectural monuments and in the way they decorated the city, and they put schools and mosques and hospitals together. Their first capital was Madia in Tunisia. Interestingly for us, Madia has a Maltese community. It is one of the closest points of Tunisia to Malta. It was what we're seeing here are Spanish walls, which are very similar to some of our own fortifications. But it was the Fatimid capital, the original Fatimid capital. This is one of its porticos on the inside of the fort. And the Fatimids built the fortifications in Cairo. These are the famous gates, Bab Zuwaila, which are all decorated a little bit like minarets, but they're the gates of the city. That's a side view. That's the chaos of Cairo. And this is David Roberts, who, with his very famous prints and lithographs of Cairo, and in this case, the Bab Zuwaila. And that's a detail of the Bab Zuwaila. And the Fatimids were overtaken, as always happens, but they had started the seed of a city of culture and of learning. And here we have the mosque and mausoleum of Ibn Qalawun, where we start to see a mosque, a hospital, and a school coming together. These are the Mamluks now, and Qalawun was one of the first Mamluks, and they were very important because they weren't that interested in conquering too many of the other countries, or rather they were, as they all were, but they also wanted to invest heavily in the place and in the learning of the city, in the learning of the people that lived in the city. You can see here Byzantine influence. There is the arch with the double arch with the column in the middle, a little bit similar to what we have in Medina itself. They were influenced by the architecture in Sicily, and there were incredible links between Sicily and Cairo at the time. And these are the first stone screens that we're seeing in Egypt, in Cairo. And that's a detail of the Byzantine-influenced window. And that is the calligraphy which then becomes present in nearly most of the Islamic buildings. This is interesting because it is a Gothic doorway which was carefully dismantled when the Mamluks were battling the Crusaders in Acre. They refused to destroy this. They said it was so beautiful that they wanted to dismantle it, and they transported it. This is one of the doorways to this mosque, which shows you that these people were not just interested in conquering, they were interested in culture and art and architecture. This is the interior of the school, and they had four Sunni schools of jurisprudence, which shows you how advanced they were. Cairo has one of the oldest universities in the world, which is still functioning, by the way. And this is the interior of one of the mosques, where you can see how the light is modulated through these very thick walls, specific windows, very well placed, to allow ventilation at a high level and to allow the light to come in at a particular angle which would light the various parts of the room as the architect intended. And this was studied by a lot of architects who visited these places, and it influenced them. This is Madia. We're going back to Madia, the causeway which links the commercial, the market square to the fort. And this is the way it is lit halfway through. So you have these dark cavernous spaces which are cool and which offer protection, but there's this high level window which gives you ventilation and light. And this is the Hagia Sophia in Istanbul, where you, again, the architects of the time managed to create this incredible span. The dome had this incredible span, and it was pierced at a low level on the drum with windows, allowing this zenithal lighting, which influenced a lot of people, including Le Corbusier, and that is Le Corbusier's sketch of his Voyage d'Orient when he went to Istanbul, amongst other places. And in fact, he is sketching the exterior of the church stroke mosque. And that is his chapel in Ronchamp, where he uses this technique of thick walls and capturing the angle of the sun when it is low in the sky, which is something which I think as architects, perhaps today we have forgotten these techniques and we need to study. And I find I'm always learning from these buildings because they really teach you how light can be modulated through the walls, through screens. We're going to go forward in time to the 19th century, where Cairo has this incredible array of the most beautiful timber screens and timber balconies and wonderful work, craftsman work of timber. We've had to jump about six centuries because obviously the timber work of the 12th and 13th century has not survived. What didn't help was that the Crusaders attacked Cairo. They left it burning for 2 months, and parts of Cairo which were destroyed in the 12th century are still a pile of debris. They never recovered. So it's quite a shame that a lot of these beautiful architectural pieces have been lost. And then, to make matters worse, in 1927 there was a program for the agrandissement of Cairo, probably sort of with the influence of the French, and they created these open spaces around these mosques and ran with bulldozers through all the old buildings around the mosques, and that destroyed a lot of other buildings. But there was this chap, Major Geyer Anderson, who started collecting all these timber screens as he saw these houses being demolished. And he gathered them in his own house. And we're going to go back briefly to The Spy Who Loved Me.
Mr. Fletcher is expecting me. I phoned him.
He asked me to give you a message.
A little bit of fun from James Bond. But they used Cairo, they used this house to film The Spy Who Loved Me. And that is the same room with the screen up top. And these screens create this walkway all the way around, this double height space, which means that you can walk secretly around and you can look down and see who there is in this in the sala d'audiencia, so an audience room. And it's fun and it's interesting architecture. And it was probably used for the women not to mix with the men and have their own quarters. That's the same screen which was. This is the terrace up top, which frames the Ibn Tulun Mosque, because he's in fact exactly, this house is exactly behind the Ibn Tulun Mosque. And these are the beautiful lattice-worked screens on the roof, which create these lovely, shaded, cool spaces on the roof. Now, what they also did was that they utilized these screens in a very clever way. They were very environmentally conscious. The air would come through the screen. A pot was placed behind the screen. The water would evaporate. As it evaporates, it loses latent heat. It takes up heat from the air, and it cools the room beyond. So that was the use of the screens originally. Now, whether our Maltese balcony is a copy, whether it was historically used in that way or not, as yet we do not have sufficient information to say so. But definitely these screens from Cairo to India to Iran were used in this way. They were a cooling technique. And this is one of them. This is one of the screens on the left-hand side, which we saw when we were going through the streets. And that is the diagram of how it is working. The photograph on the right is taken from the research done by, this is research done by the University of Nottingham, apart from the initial research, which was done by one of the most famous Cairo architects to have lived since the pyramids, was somebody called Hassan Fathi. And he explored the origins of all these beautiful Islamic buildings in Cairo. More timber screens in a pretty bad shape. Some other type of balcony type screen. And these, again, there's this beautiful timber work, which is nearly Turkish in its type, with these long eaves, which were used, and you find these in the old part of Cairo. They were called Sabil Kutabs. And they were a Mamluk addition to the city because they wanted to introduce fresh running water. So the Sabil was a fountain at a low level, and you provided people with fresh running water. The Kutab was a little school, a little room, where the children were taught the Quran. And these Sabil Kutabs were put in various parts of old Cairo. This is a relatively modern house in the center of Cairo, which has explored the use of timber screens and uses current craftsmen to create these beautiful timber screens again. With the opening, the bottom bit would open and you'd be able to look through. And our own Persiani louvers have usually four louvers which twist to allow you to peep through and see who is downstairs or who is at the front door. This is in the same house. And this is a screen which was rescued. It's 18th to 19th century, and it was taken to the Louvre. In 2012, the Louvre opened the Islamic wing. It was designed by Rudo Ricciotti and Mario Bellini. If you're in Paris, I urge you to go. It's very beautiful. It is a screen-like mesh, gold mesh, which floats like a cloud over a courtyard. And beneath this mesh are the artifacts, the Islamic artifacts. So it feels as if you're underneath a tent. This is a section through of how the courtyard was excavated and two stories were created and this sail-like roof floats on top. And that is what it feels like beneath it, with all the beautiful artifacts, this natural light pouring in, but there's also this diffused light, which is very beautiful. This is an example of Fatimid art at the Louvre, and it is one of the few examples which is figurative, because one of the important aspects of Islamic art is that it is non-figurative, which meant that geometric designs were explored to a complexity which now we will see in Granada, which is unbelievable. But there are a few examples of figurative work. This is ivory, and it shows the hunt, the Fatimids in the process of hunting, drinking, music and dance. This is again at the Louvre, where they rescued a few pieces from buildings in Cairo. This is a door which is inlaid, which again explores this geometric intricate design and uses all these beautiful woods and ivory. That's a detail of it. Incredible craftsmanship. And that is the back of the door. So next time you have workmen who say, well, nobody's going to see it, and tell them actually the back of things is equally as important. And this is a screen in the 16th, 17th century. It's a jali now, and we're moving. This is a typical work of Mughal architecture, Rajasthan. And this is when the geometric designs become floral. and they take on a Persian aspect of gardens, of acanthus leaves, of, you know, this beautiful vine, intertwining vines, and that is the Persian garden which is coming through onto Arabic decorative pieces. In this case, this is sandstone, which is hand-carved. And now we are going to Granada, where the types of decorative effects on the walls are unbelievable. This is one of the geometric shapes. This is another one. This is the famous shapes which you see throughout most of the friezes. And this is yet another decorative effect. And this is Granada. It is a fort. It is in the hills. The first fort dates, I believe, to the 8th century. Those are the hills beyond. No, it's in the 11th century. Apologies, that's the fort in the back. That's the portico. These beautiful ponds, serene places, which play with the theme of a reflecting pool, of shade, of coolness, of light being captured into the dark, cool spaces. 14th century, most of the Alhambra is 14th century in origin. These are one of the corridors, the decoration which goes from walls to ceiling with inlaid doors. This is the hall of the Abencerrages, where every single surface is decorated and the light captures it. In this case, you're seeing the halogen lights, but if you sit there without the lights, then you see the light coming in and shining off these decorated walls. And this is the Caliphal Horseshoe Arch, which is at its full grandeur in Cordoba and Seville. The Nasrids, which took over in Cordoba, also developed the Almohad Sebha, which is the geometric design we were seeing before, the Almohad Palm, which is the floral type of decorative effects, stilted arches, which we'll see, and Mukarnas, and I'll point them out to you. This is one of the other walls. So these are the Mukarnas. These stalactite-like elements are called Mukarnas. And if you remember the slide of Ibn Tulun, you see the beginnings of this in Cairo. And this is the famous Court of the Lions. Reflecting pool. This is the exterior of these beautiful palaces, which fell into ruin when there was the Reconquista. The Spaniards took over. They plastered over all the wall decorations. A lot of them were cleaned up, but the gold leaf was lost. A lot of the inlaid precious stones were lost, and entire palaces were lost. Charles V decided to build his Baroque palace. But thankfully, a lot of Granada has been saved. And this is Irving Washington, who traveled to Granada when it was still a ruin. And he said this: "During a summer's residence in the old Moorish palace of the Alhambra, of which I have already given numerous anecdotes to the public, I used to pass much of my time in the beautiful hall of the Abencerrages, beside the fountain celebrated in the tragic story of that devoted race." And he talks about the Nasrids and how wonderful they were, and how the Reconquista was actually an inferior race to the Nasrids. And this is the typical reflecting pool effect. Now we're going to look at the gardens of Generalife outside the Alhambra, where you get each part of the garden named after the plants. So there's the garden of the myrtles, and there's the garden of roses, and it's all sensory. It's all about water and smells and shade and light. And we, here at this point, we move to Seville, where there is the Alcázar, where we see a similar development of Nazarene architecture with the Sala de Audiencias, probably in a better condition because it wasn't left to rot as was Granada. This is one of the domes, 1427, Diego Ruiz. And these are the mucarnas. This is the epitome of this highly decorated architecture in Spain, with the mucarnas in the corners on the bases of the domes. The Salón de Embajadores. These are the stilted arches with these stalactite elements. And that is a screen worked in stone. And that's the effect on the inside. And again, we have these wonderful ponds, reflecting ponds, and beautiful gardens with citrus and porticos and shade. And what they are trying to do here is they're trying to capture, as I mentioned earlier, the Persian concept of paradise, which is depicted, as we all know, in many of the carpets, Persian carpets, where you have this wonderful geometric laid out gardens. And because the origin of this is Persian, we're now going to go to North India, where we have the Turco-Mongol prince Babur, who conquers Delhi. And one of the first monuments of importance is the Humayun's tomb, which is this geometrically laid out garden with water, fountains, and probably at one point in time citrus. When the British had extended their influence over the gardens in India, they changed a lot of the citrus trees to lawns. So we all know what the Taj Mahal looks like, and it's got lawns on either side, but those would have been citrus trees. And these are the type of interior spaces that you find in North India. This is the Humayun tomb. The screens now are carved in stone. And again, we're talking about the 15th century, and as we go to the 16th, 17th, 18th century, it becomes this incredible exuberance in the screens with floral depictions, and it's Rococo, it's nearly Rococo. This is Humayun's tomb, which remains simple and calm, and that's Burckhardt talking about the quality of light. There is no more perfect symbol of the divine unity than light. For this reason, the Muslim artist seeks to transform the very stuff he is fashioning into a vibration of light. And one of the other important monuments, 1572, so sort of contemporary with our founding of Valletta, is Fatehpur Sikri, which is where Akbar, again, of Mongolian descent, decided to build his capital, which is this red stone, incredible series of buildings, which was then abandoned, probably because of lack of water. And we see these beautiful, simple, but rich buildings. And these are the screens in Fatehpur Sikri. And these are all carved in, hand-carved in stone. And one of the other important rulers in Rajasthan was Shah Jahan. And he was also an astronomer, and he wanted to try to experiment with building all sorts of monuments to try to capture the secrets of the sky and the stars and the moon and the sun. They were mathematicians and astronomers, and there's this incredible park with all these monuments which try to capture the sun in a particular angle. And this is Jaipur. Palace of Winds. Unfortunately, it is only a screen. What was behind collapsed, but the screen remains there. And this is again Jaipur, Fotamer, where you see this exuberance of craftsmanship. This is inlaid with mirror and ivory, so it creates this scintillating effect. It's like being inside a jewel. And this is the view from the fort onto Jaipur. Onto Jodhpur, the blue city, where in India, without a planning authority, they ensure that people can only paint their buildings blue or white in this particular. And this is another palace where you see this incredible workmanship. So now I'm going to take you to how all of this has influenced architects today. And it's only influenced architects today because following the incredible wealth of the 18th century and the kingdoms which allowed such wealth to exist and to employ thousands of craftsmen to hand carve these screens, the 19th and the 20th and the 21st century didn't have that. It was not economically possible. However, today there are methods. There's laser cutting and water jet cutting, which we will talk about, which allows us to explore in the past 10 years, creating patterns in materials to modulate light. This is a screen in metal by a relatively well-known Swiss architect who plays with light in an incredible way in his buildings. He's called Peter Zumthor. This is his spa called Vals in Switzerland. This is concrete laid on the inside of a tree. Sorry, the other way around, and then it's, the tree is burnt and you get that effect with light coming in. And this is Peter Zumthor with a beard, and he says this: when I concentrate on a specific site or place for which I am going to design a building, when I try to plumb its depths, its form, its history, and its sensuous qualities, images of other places start to invade this process of precise observation. Images of places I know and that once impressed me. Images of ordinary or special places. Places that I carry with me as inner visions of specific moods and qualities. Images of architectural situations which emanate from the world of art, of films, theatre or literature. And in a way, this is what I'm trying to do with these slides of Islamic architecture. And many architects do the same. We learn a lot from the buildings that we visit and experience. This is one of his projects. There are many interesting projects that he's put together, but this is interesting because he starts to use stone screens around the ruins, the medieval ruins of a church. This is Cologne in Germany. And this is a stone screen. And that's the effect on the inside where he creates this modulated light. This is the water jet cutting, which allows us today to create such effects. It uses, thousands of bars of pressure with concentrated water to cut through stone. It's linked to a machine which takes the drawing, a 3D drawing that you produce of anything, from a chair to a statue to a screen, and it produces that in stone or in any other material that it can cut without producing heat. Laser cutting is used for materials up till about 1620 millimeters, so steel or wood, but it produces heat, so one has to know the advantages and disadvantages of these techniques. And this is somebody else who's experimenting with screens, and his another famous international famous architect, Stephen Hall. He's an American, and this is a bench, and these are sheets of metal where he is experimenting in a book which is called Porosity. So he creates these translucent spaces, translucent screens, where to modulate the light within the spaces beyond. And to give you an example of his work, this is the New York University Department of Philosophy, an early 20th century building which needed a new staircase. So his sketch is showing how he wanted to draw down into the building with a new staircase. And he does this by utilizing these screens made of metal, which are all painted white, which then project into the rooms with the old cast iron structure. And this is the staircase beyond. And another famous architectural group, Herzog and de Meuron, who are experimenting again with screens. This is the CAIXA Forum Madrid, and they look as if they're not too happy, but actually they're hugely successful. And they create these structures which sit on another old building. They're most known for the Prada building in Tokyo, which utilizes these huge glass elements, some of which are clear, some which create different effects of people so that you can look in, and sometimes it transforms the space within or on the outside. But going back to Madrid, this is the Madrid building, which sits on a base of another building. And this is the effect that they've created on the inside with their screens, which are a little bit like a material which has gone through a passage of time. It looks like it's weathered. And this is what some interior designers are doing. This is Barcelona, Patricia Urquiola, the interior of the Mandarin in Barcelona, where she uses this paper-like screen to create this very rich interior of the main hall of the hotel. So it's like a piece of paper which floats. And the shape, it's more decorative, and the shape is echoed in the design of the carpet. So you get, I don't know if you remember the slide of Humayun's tomb, where there was a screen with a pattern and the same pattern on the wall, and this interior designer is doing the same thing. That is the entry point, which is quite austere. Carlos Ferrater is the Spanish architect who designed it. And more recently, winning a lot of awards, is a building which is a hotel, the Aman Hotel in Delhi, designed by Kerry Hill Architects. They are Australian, where, because he's living in Singapore, this architectural company is in Singapore, they are studying the forms which emanate from Mughal architecture. And here you get a screen which is more sympathetic towards Islamic architecture, and architecturally hugely successful without being kitsch. And he uses things such as reflecting pools and arcades, but it's a modern idiom. And these are some of his other buildings, which again, where he's playing with light. And now I'd like to show you what is being done in Malta, locally. And I didn't want to come here and just talk about the architecture which our office is doing. I wanted to also show you some architectural pieces which some of my colleagues are doing, which I find particularly interesting. This is a screen in the Malta Enterprise Building, which sits inside St. Luke's. I think it is a hugely successful project. I really commend the architects who put it together, Lautier and Parch. And the screen is built out of hard stone, and it divides the reception space from the waiting area. And it's two stories high. These are some examples of the water jet cutting which Halman are doing. And they have a very talented man within their organization called Paul Vella, and he does these wonderful things which they're experimenting with. And this is what our office has recently completed. It is the extension to the brewery, the Farsons Brewery. The program was quite complicated, but one of the things which I would like to draw your attention to is this metal mesh, this aluminium actually, bronze-colored mesh, which envelops the entire building and creates shading and a ventilated space. and it wraps its way around the offices. And they're currently doing studies, and they have achieved something like 40% shading on the glass, and about 5 degrees Celsius cooling from the peak temperatures in summer. These are the interior spaces. The mesh was also placed upside down, and it wasn't a mistake. The quality of the mesh allowed certain shading to be so intense that it would have meant that the lighting would have to be, the energy would have been utilized to create more lighting within the offices. So they switched it around for two reasons. One, to not need artificial lighting during daytime hours, and secondly, to be able to screen people working in the offices from the street. It was still successful and achieved, as I said, 40% shading on average. This is another project of ours where we utilize the screen, which you may be familiar with, the Baraka lift, which is a very functional structure. I don't think you can even call it a building, which is basically two lifts, built out of concrete and clad in a very simple, cost-effective screen, which gives it an envelope, but allowing the breeze to come through, creating shade, and creating a monolithic structure. And this is what the screen looks from the inside. And this again won an award, an international architecture award. And lastly, I'd like to end with possibly a controversial project in Malta, which we're all familiar with. But what I wanted to draw attention to was, this is one of the models which were put up before Renzo Piano's building started to be put into place. The concept behind the cladding of the Parliament building is in itself a screen, and it is a shading device. And the angles of each of the hard stone wedges create the appropriate shading for the windows beyond. So these are the windows beyond, and the angles allow the sun to not hit the interior spaces at its peak. This is just a prototype. So no, there is no sea in Republic Street. But this is the building as it is today. This photo was taken yesterday. This is the cavernous space on the interior. And this is the building as it is, again, photo taken yesterday by my patient husband, whom I sent to take the latest photo. And I'd like to thank you all for listening. And I'd like to thank Francesca for asking me, because it's been great fun putting these slides together. And I'd like to thank my husband for all the wonderful photos that he always takes when we travel. Thank you very much.
First of all, Crozet. Two comments and a question. Comment number one, the effect of cooling by a jar of earthenware jar with water in it. I believe the Mashrabiya in Malta had that function, and we destroyed them all, which is a pity. There were some that were still around. I remember them in Sijiwi, and even here in Indien. I think there was one, but anyway. Comment number two. There is the Institut du Monde Arabe in Paris, and this could be tied with your visit, that has a magnificent way of controlling light. The pattern is very Islamic, but the pattern is made out by a series of computer-controlled diaphragms, like camera diaphragms, that open and close according to the intensity of light. Worth a visit.
Yes, Jean Nouvel. And unfortunately, there's one last time I went, it was not functioning.
The wonders of technology. but my question is, what relationship or what influence was there between the Islamic colonnades and the garden and all that with the cloisters? the Benedictine cloisters, you know, the cloisters that we see around in Europe, all over Europe, because there is that aspect of columns, garden, fountains, serenity, and so on.
It's all linked to the architectural means of the place. So a lot of the North African examples are very much rooted in Roman architecture. And again, a lot of the cloistered, the convents and the cloisters, depending on where they were, would borrow on the same architectural techniques and know-how of the place. I would say one of the architectural techniques which traveled throughout the Mediterranean was the need to create cool spaces, to create cavernous spaces, to create porticos to distance the sun from rooms that you needed to be able to sleep, eat, function in. And that created a typology. The courtyard was of defensive purposes. It didn't allow anybody to come in. But it also, with the presence of fountains, ponds, reflecting pools, it was a cool space. And there were trees, there were the citrus trees. We still have some convents like that. If you then look at convents in Switzerland and Germany, then they are of a different nature. So there is a thread through the development of architecture from Cordoba right through to Rajasthan because of the environmental requirements, the need for shade, the need for cooling is all because of the environment. And I don't think you're going to see that typology then go north.
Across the Jhana, we've really benefited enormously from your extensive travels, from the documentation of your travels as well, all these wonderful buildings that you've shown us. And what I found particularly striking was the connections that you made between East and West, North and South. That's wonderful. Thank you so much. Once again, it has been a real education for me today just to sit through this lecture. Really wonderful. Thank you all for being here, for participating. And just a gentle reminder about joining the Friends program. If you do wish to become friends of Palazzo Falson, there are forms at the back of the hall which we invite you to fill in. And thank you very much.
You have just listened to a talk organized by Palazzo Falson entitled Blades of Light. The talk was delivered by Joanne Spiteri-Staines.